Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a guest co-host, Dr. Samir Arora from the University of North Carolina. Welcome, Samir.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You know, we've actually talked about some of your cardiology research on this show before, and it's important work that you're doing, and we're glad that you're actually sharing some of your expertise to talk about research and have our conversation today with Dr. Louise Metz about how providers can provide better care for transgender non-binary patients.
Yes, of course. I think that's a great topic.
I know I didn't get any training on when I was in medical school or residency, but it's one that I've recognized how important it is and trying to get up to speed and provide the best care that we can. We'll have that opportunity to have this conversation with Dr. Metz, but first we're going to talk about some research that matters. And the very first one I think is kind of striking. It's research out of the University of Kentucky about how the race and the ethnicity of students may impact the type of discipline they get in school. This was research published in the Journal of School Psychology.
Yes. So the project analyzed how ethnicity and race were associated with school discipline practices. And the study basically found that African-American youth were more likely to be expelled.
They were looking at 16,000 middle schools. This is in the 2014, the U.S. Department of Education database, over 22 million adolescents. And certainly it was across certain ethnic and racial groups, with the African-American students, as you said, as well as students who were two or more races, were increased risk of being suspended or expelled compared to white students in both middle and high schools. Also, schools that had higher poverty rates or were a little more diverse, actually, seemed to have students that were getting expelled more often. What does this mean? I mean, this is, I don't think we can say fully that there's, you know, does this mean that there's 100% discrimination? But I think that it certainly raises the specter.
Yes, it definitely provides evidence of systematic differences in how school disciplinary actions are applied. And this is really concerning for the future of America, as these are the young children that we want to go further and become engineers, doctors, and, you know, go into different fields and go into the military. We don't want them to be expelled for reasons that they really don't need to be expelled for.
In our next research that matters, we're going from the frying pan into the fire, I think, but it's about the dramatic rise in drug overdoses and suicides, as well as alcohol increased death rates among millennials. And what we should define as millennials is those who were born between 1981 and 1996. That applies to a lot of the population of the United States.
One of the striking results from the study, as I read it, young adults experienced a 35% increase in suicide rates between 2007 and 2017, compared with a 14% increase for 35 to 54-year-olds. That's a drastic difference.
Right. Alcohol-induced death rates doubled for millennials between 1999 and 2007. Young adults had a 35% increase, as you said, in suicide rates. And, you know, this is research that actually came out of the Trust for America's Health and Well-Being, and they really talked about how we need to provide mental health coverage so much quicker and available. I mean, it's well over a week. We know from our own experience it can be months sometimes before you can get in to see a mental health provider. Insurance coverage and other strategies.
Yes, and as the Chief Strategic Officer, Mr. Benjamin Miller, pointed out, this is really a call for action. It is just unacceptable for us to lose as many lives as we are losing. 150,000 lives just to drugs, alcohol, and suicide is just alarming.
Well, I think we're going to be able to do some deep dives on this and really talk about things that we can do differently and things we can advocate differently. Our next research that matters, I think, is I wouldn't say it's humorous, but it's something we might do differently that actually can have an impact. But on the first read, you might think, oh, this is kind of what's this about? And it's called food Neophobia. I had not heard that term before.
Yes, and it refers to a fear of new foods. I just didn't know this term existed. I know a lot of people who have this, but I just didn't know a term like this existed. And this shocking study shows that there's an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes in people who have food neophobia.
Yeah, let's do a little bit more explanation. This was actually came out of Finland, and it looked at individuals between 25 and 74 who were followed for 7 years. You know, and we see this in kids, picky eaters, but then adults who, you know, they will avoid more diversity in vegetables. They may eat foods that are higher in fat. They may limit fiber and protein, and the monounsaturated, the healthy fatty acids are lower. And so there's a mechanism by which this fear of new foods, which could be a fear of kale, fear of high fiber things like beans, or even high protein things like soy and tofu.
Absolutely correct. When I was a kid, my parents always used to tell me to eat a balanced diet. And I think that's one of the things that the investigators speculated, that these people who have food neophobia are just not eating a balanced diet. And it looks like they're having a high lipid content in their blood. So the cholesterol levels are high, which obviously associated with higher cardiovascular disease. And it's also has an association with that, with their type 2 diabetes.
So if you're a listener out there and you maybe have a neophobia, you are fearful of some new food, we're going to encourage you to experiment with it. Certain vegetables, certain proteins that you may not have experienced that are low in fats, high in protein, high in fiber, let's go try them.
That is exactly right. Versatility is the name of the game here.
Quinoa. Our last research that matters, it's about us. When we're ill, are we still providing care to people and potentially spreading illness? This doesn't surprise me, but it's still shocking.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually feel as one of these healthcare workers who may have at some point in time in the past worked when I felt I had mild symptoms.
Yeah, this was actually in the journal Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology. In over 4 seasons in 9 Canadian hospitals, they had illness diaries in several thousand participants. They basically found that 69% of those who had worked during an illness said they had symptoms and felt well enough to work. I remember one day I was working in my office and I didn't feel good. I wasn't sure what was happening. And then all of a sudden I realized I may have a fever coming on. And I had one of my staff going, "Dr. Goldstein, you don't look too well. Well, I've missed 2.5 days and 33 years of work." That was a day I went home. And listening to your colleagues, listening to that internal voice that says, you know, if you're sick, don't give it to someone else. And I see colleagues sometimes, I tell them, you need to go home. We need to tell our colleagues, go home.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I remember being in training, and you always feel like you don't want to let your attending down. You don't want to be the one who comes across as, oh, this guy always makes excuses. But at the same time, it's important that if you're sick, you don't want to make your patient sick through your sickness.
Yeah, I'd rather let my colleagues down than make a patient sick.
That is.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to have an important conversation with Dr. Louise Metz, founder of Mosaic Comprehensive Care, about how providers can provide better care for transgender and non-binary patients. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Samira Arora. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Louise Metz of Mosaic Comprehensive Care about how providers can provide better care for transgender and non-binary patients. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Metz.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are really excited to have you on the show. And I know Laura Lace, our executive producer, and I were talking about the need for education, the need for education of providers and patients and the public about an issue you read about daily. And before we jump into it, though, I think we'd like to know a little bit about you and your path to medicine and women's health and the health of everyone. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm from this area. I went to Duke undergrad and then to UNC Medical School nearby. And when I was in undergrad, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do for a living, but I took some classes in women's studies. And in doing so, I took a class in women's health and a class in the history of women in science and medicine. And that was towards the end of college. And it was through those classes that I decided I wanted to pursue medicine and in particular had a passion for women's health. First drove me into medicine.
Which led you to ultimately setting up your own practice.
Right, yeah, a few steps in between there. But yeah, I went to UNC for medical school and then out to California for my residency. And while I was out there at UCSF, had some really unique experiences working in various community clinics, both to pursue women's health interests and really to pursue care for marginalized groups has always been a passion of mine. And in particular, while I was out there, I had my first exposure to transgender health at a clinic called the Lyon Martin Clinic in San Francisco, which started in the 1970s. And they were really a leader in San Francisco in providing transgender care back when it was very scarce.
Yeah, that's a very intriguing topic. What kind of pathologies do you work with in transgender patients?
So the way I look at transgender care, and I like to use the term gender-affirming care, and really I think of it as part of primary care that we really provide to all people. Mm-hmm. So our philosophy and mission at our practice at Mosaic is to provide inclusive and affirming care for all people, including people of all genders. And so my vision for the future is that gender-affirming care is just considered part of primary care. That it's not a specialty, or you don't need to go to a special doctor or a specialist to receive this care, but that it's really included in part of general primary care, just like you would receive menopausal hormone care or care for your high blood pressure and diabetes. So that's how I see gender-affirming care hopefully evolving over time.
Let's just take a pause and say, help us understand definitions here, because I think people hear so many different things. What are like basic transgender 101? What are the 5, 4, 3 terms that I think is important that if we're going to have a conversation, we should understand so that we are respectful?
Definitely. I think that's really important to step back and look at that. So the first definition I would start with is, what does sex mean? So sex assigned at birth, to start with that. So that refers to the sex assigned to an individual at birth, usually based on chromosomal or anatomic characteristics. And so typically in our society, we each receive an assigned sex at birth. Gender identity is something different. So that's one's internal perception of one's gender. And one's internal perception of their gender may not align with their sex assigned at birth.
So you could be born XX female, but you may not feel like female.
Right. So your own gender identity may not align with what you've been assigned at birth.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's really helpful to distinguish those two things. And then gender expression is another term I think is helpful to know, and that refers to one's outward presentation in terms of their gender. And the gender expression may or may not fit with one's gender identity. So it's important to make sure we don't make assumptions based on how someone looks, that we can't assume based on their gender expression what their gender identity is.
Help us give me an example of how that may be.
So that people may have assumptions about how someone dresses or their mannerisms and may sometimes assume based on those mannerisms or clothes or jewelry or things that someone wears that might tell us about their gender identity. But really, you don't know someone's gender identity until you ask them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really that only that person can really tell you.
And so how do you ask? What's the question you ask?
So I ask, what is your gender identity? I also ask about pronouns, and we can talk about that too if it's helpful. But I think, just in a non-judgmental way, asking what one's gender identity is.
And when we talk about people who were born male but associate with being female or, mm-hmm. or vice versa, are there terms that people use that, again, can help us understand what they mean?
Yes. So transgender male and transgender female are terms that are commonly used. So a transgender male is an individual who was assigned female at birth, but their gender identity is male. And then a transgender female is someone who was assigned male at birth and their gender identity is female.
No matter what they may look like at this point in time, it's how they think about it. And so when we are talking with them, although we would use their name because
correct.
That's their name, but their name may have changed or may not
that's
have
correct.
Changed, right?
That's correct.
And then we have to say, help us understand in terms of the healthcare environment, what are the issues, just like anyone else, that you're here wanting to talk about today?
Right. That's exactly right. And I think really that's very important, is really asking that individual how they identify. And one rule of thumb is the only way to know someone's gender identity is by asking them. And even that holds true for providers who might be working with someone in terms of their gender identity or gender dysphoria. So really the only way to know is to ask that individual.
From the medical perspective, what medical needs are more specific to the non-binary patients?
So before I answer that, I'll explain what non-binary means. Mm-hmm. That's another good definition. So in our society, there is a social construct that really defines gender based on a binary. And that means that in general, we think of male and female as being the only two genders. And that is really a social construct. When in reality, gender identity falls on a spectrum. Just like sex falls on a spectrum, right? We know that there are people who are intersex, so that's a spectrum. Gender expression is a spectrum. And gender identity is also a spectrum. So there are some individuals who identify as what we would call gender queer or gender non-binary. And those individuals may not identify with either gender. They may identify with both, or they may feel like they fluidly identify with either over time. So that's sort of the definition and when you ask about non-binary. And then your question was about sort of
medical.
The health needs, the medical
and,
needs.
And as we think about this topic, the things that I really am acutely aware of is the discrimination
yes.
and the bullying and the trauma that I see play out, at least in the news. And I just can't not imagine that if I'm taking care of patients, I need to really be much more sensitive and aware than even I would be in a normal circumstance.
Definitely. And I think that's another really important point. And there is so much discrimination, unfortunately, in our society and in others that transgender individuals face. And in particular, transgender folks face that discrimination within healthcare. And I think it's important to note that you know, doctors themselves are not immune to bias. And that can be a form of discrimination that patients experience. In fact, 1 in 5 transgender individuals will say that they avoid healthcare due to fear of discrimination.
And how does that play out in a provider's office? Give an example of like someone maybe, they wouldn't even know they're doing it maybe. Or
right. Yeah. It's often inadvertent because people aren't educated enough to know. And so that might play out, you know, when someone checks into the doctor's office, that the front desk might use the incorrect name. They might use their legal name, but we know the patient is using a different name or a different pronoun. And so that might make that patient feel uncomfortable in the waiting room. They may feel unsafe in the doctor's office.
So you have to do training for your staff.
Exactly. That's very
yeah.
important.
We need to take a short break. When we return, though, we're going to continue having this important conversation with Dr. Louise Metz of Mosaic Comprehensive Care about how providers can provide better care for transgender and non-binary patients. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Samira Arora. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Louise Metz of Mosaic Comprehensive Care about how providers can better provide care for transgender and non-binary patients. And right before the break, Dr. Metz, you'd really help us to find and understand the terms, including non-binary and how to create an environment and a healthcare system that is facilitative and compassionate, maybe even show some courage, and what happens when we don't. How in society are we doing? Because my suspicions are we've got a long way to go.
Unfortunately, you're exactly right. We do have a long way to go. There are very high rates of discrimination in our society against transgender folks. Unfortunately, you may hear reports in the news. You may have heard some lately about violence against transgender individuals. So it's a very, very serious problem in our society. And I think it's important for us to do our part in the medical field to try to work towards decreasing that discrimination.
We also know, at least I've read, that the rates of suicidal thoughts and perhaps actions is much higher. How does that influence what you think about when you're seeing people with transgender who are in your office?
So I think that's very important as well. And we do know that there are high rates of suicide attempts among transgender folks. And I believe one study showed that 40% of transgender individuals had a history of a suicide attempt, and that 10% in that study in the previous year did. And that higher rate of mental illness is from a combination of things, including the stigma and discrimination that transgender folks experience.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of message for primary care physicians as how they can actually rectify the situations and how they can handle transgender patients in their clinic?
I do. So I think there are a lot of very simple things that can be done in an office. And we mentioned earlier educating the staff. So it's not just the providers that need to understand how to practice gender-affirming care, but really the whole staff. And so in our office, we do have trainings for our entire staff. And again, that is important from the moment the patient walks in the office. So we always say that the first person that patient sees is the most important, just even at the check-in desk. And need to make sure we are respecting individuals' correct names and correct pronouns, and making an effort on our part to make sure that information is passed from each person, from the front desk to the medical assistant to the provider to the lab staff, so that everyone can really affirm that individual. So I think that's very important. I also think that having inclusive images in the office, on the walls, so that patients can see other people that look like them. And this applies not just to gender-affirming care, but I think to affirming care for all people. And so I think those are some of the things that we can do. And then I think providers need to make sure they are well-educated about some of these statistics that we've talked about, and need to be well-versed in gender-affirming care that I think, again, should be able to be provided in all primary care settings.
You talked about your real interest in marginalized populations, and this was kind of what led you in part in your training and interest. How has that interest really spawned into what some might consider more of a specialty there? What sorts of things did you see? And then as you care for this population, how does this kind of go back up into caring for other marginalized populations? Because I imagine they feed with each other.
Definitely. And I think that one important point here is that marginalized populations, because of the discrimination and stigma that they experience in society and in healthcare, we're starting to see more and more literature showing us that the stigma that individuals experience increases risk of disease. And so if we're seeing transgender individuals having a higher rate of certain diseases, we've talked about mental illness, but there may be others, that it may be that the stigma experience, so the internalized stigma and oppression, actually is a factor in increasing risk of disease. This also applies to people in larger bodies. And so this is also a passion of mine. So we practice weight inclusive care at our practice. And we know that individuals in larger bodies experience weight stigma. And we have a lot of literature showing us that weight stigma increases risk of hypertension, heart disease, diabetes. And so we need to start thinking a little outside the box and kind of step back and think, well, what else could be contributing to this increased risk of disease besides genetics or other environmental factors, that actually experiencing discrimination affects one's long-term health?
I'm thinking about one of the transgender patients that I saw, you know, in the distant past, who had been in and out with discrimination and stigma, but also, you know, real abuse and in and out of hospitals. And I felt inadequate. I felt overwhelmed. But then I started thinking, well, you know, I could feel overwhelmed with anyone who has such a large kind of burden of illness and disease. And I was just thinking, it must take a team approach frequently. Talk about the team approach, how that plays out here. What do you need?
Definitely. And the team approach is crucial. So as I mentioned earlier, that team approach within an office. So really making sure there's communication among the different staff members in an office, and that each part of that visit is very important. And also collaborating with community team members. So communicating with therapists who are caring for patients and really making sure that we're all working together with the goal of supporting each individual and helping them with the discrimination they have experienced and think about how it connects to their health, including their mental health.
And what about hormones? Because I imagine there's a deeper specialty within transgender care, which is supporting people and who are changing.
That's right. So gender-affirming hormone care is usually the term we use to refer to that. And it applies to the hormone care that we can provide to assist someone in transition and in affirming their gender identity. And there are various hormone regimens. And one point I would make about that is it sounds like a highly specialized area. I sort of alluded to this earlier, but the actual provision of the hormones is fairly straightforward and can be learned with proper training by any provider. And it's something that we can offer to our patients in the primary care setting.
And most insurance companies actually pay for it. If I was looked this up too long ago, I was like, oh, that's more progressive than I thought.
It is variable insurance to insurance. And we have seen a bit of a decline lately. At least in our state, in terms of coverage of hormone care. But we do really work hard to advocate for our patients with the insurance companies to try to get the hormones approved.
Yeah, just coming back to your point about research into marginalized patients, mm-hmm. how much data do you think we have specifically for transgender patients? I know we talked about disparities in race, disparities in gender, but what about transgender patients specifically?
Good question. We are lacking research. And so, you know, when I talk about stigma, some of that I was sort of extrapolating from literature we have, like you said, in terms of racial stigma, body size stigma. We don't have much research in transgender care and how that affects health. And that's a really important area. And we really need to advocate for more research in this field so that we can really better provide for our patients.
Yeah, I think we were talking before the show about how the rates of heart disease are higher in transgender. And, you know, maybe that's surprising, maybe that's not surprising.
Right.
But it helps us focus in on, well, just like anyone who is in society today, heart disease is the number one killer, and we should be really aware of it and pay attention to it, not ignore it.
Exactly. Exactly. I think so. And really also kind of step back and ask more questions. And, you know, why might that be? And how else can we look into that to figure out how to prevent disease?
So if I were asking one final question, I'm going to have you give us a crystal ball, Dr. Metz, and tell us 5 years from now, we're having you back on the show, what are three or four things you think that have occurred that or let you hope have occurred that really have changed the landscape of a day-to-day practice of caring for mm-hmm. people who are transgender?
Really hope that in 5 years that we would see more primary care practices and specialty practices really actively seeking to provide affirming care for transgender individuals as well as all people. But I do think that we can really see progress, and I think that these are really simple things that can be implemented, and that with increasing education of providers and staff members at small clinics as well as in the big systems, I really can see a time in the near future where transgender individuals could seek care and feel accepted and included and receive total primary care, including their gender-affirming care in various places.
And do there need to be any changes in terms of policies? Is there any discrimination or laws or that you think we may need to change or address?
We do. We do. We have a long way to go there. So we do need to continue to advocate for equality in laws, both locally and at the federal level, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we really want to thank you, Dr. Louise Metz of Mosaic Comprehensive Care, for the care that you're providing that's comprehensive. and compassionate to marginalized and to really everyone, and really hope that your work and the work of others who are really leading the way and helping us all understand how to provide better care for transgender and non-binary patients really advances.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having me to talk about this really important topic.
We've been talking with Dr. Louise Metz of Mosaic Comprehensive Care about how providers can and should provide better care for transgender and non-binary patients. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Samir Arora. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I'm applying to a long-term care facility, and the deadline for getting my medical clearance form done was 2 days away. I called my doctor's office to get them to fill it out. I heard my doctor was going on vacation that week, however, and they asked me to come on to have another provider fill it out. But the appointment date they gave me was actually the day after the forms were due. I was pretty upset with this and went to a different provider to get them filled out. Should they have seen me sooner?
These are one of those questions that there's almost a no-win situation if you dive into it, but I think we have to dive into it.
Yeah, I agree. I'll take a shot at it. I think they should have. Maybe when you call the office, you should have just stated that it's extremely urgent and this is the date and you really need it done.
Yeah, I think that is probably the best idea. And you know, that may have occurred in this situation, and they still may have said, that's what we can do. Now, if you're an established patient in a practice, you know, we try to work these things out. And I think it's reasonable, you know, 2 or 3 days is a reasonable time. On the other hand, if you needed a full physical, which you may well have needed for this sort of situation, that may be difficult. And then there's responsibility probably on the patients then to say, you gave them 2 days notice. I mean, you know, most of us would say, I'm going to give my doctor more than 2 days notice, because you probably had that form for weeks, if not months, right?
That's exactly right. And I think it's just one of those situations in which, you know, both of us were in a tough spot, the doctor and the patient. And I guess if it kind of worked out at the end, be it you go into a different practice, at least it worked out for you. But yeah, it was just a tough situation, I think.
And we also know that continuity of care is so important. So even if you went to that different practice to get that done, I would, you know, make an appointment with your doctor and just have an honest conversation about your expectations, what their expectations, and see if you meet in the middle. Because, you know, finding a new doctor who can give you good care, that's probably not as easy.
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, the 2 days notice was short, so maybe this time I think you should go back to your original doctor and just kind of have a conversation. But at the same time, you know, 2 days, that's kind of short.
Right? Yeah, I wonder if you could have called the long-term care facility and say, hey, I wonder if we can get an extension. That seemed way have been the easiest sort of thing. Let's get an extension for 2 or 3 weeks. And they probably would have said, okay.
Yeah, I think it was worth a try to do that. And if they had said, okay, it was good. If not, then, you know, your plan B was always there. So,
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've heard that telehealth is now an option for people to get all sorts of care. I live an hour away from my primary care physician, and I'd really like to lose some weight. Do you think telehealth is an option for me? I feel it's possibly a good alternative for me to become a little bit healthier.
Well, that's a great question. I'm really excited because I think that's becoming more of an option today than it was yesterday, and it will certainly be options tomorrow.
Yes, especially because there remains a shortage of doctors in rural areas in North Carolina and the rest of the country. And telehealth is really coming along pretty well, especially, you know, with regards to certain things like what you just mentioned, obesity medicine.
Yeah, and we should also understand that telehealth doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be free. So people have to be willing to say, okay, my insurance what pay for it? And the answer is increasingly yes. If it's a something that you can do in the office and it can do as successfully out of the office, they may pay for it. And you have to be willing also maybe to pay for it. So there may be certain co-pays that aren't done that you would, maybe when you came in the office, you'd have to pay $10 or $20. You might have to do that in the telehealth version of things, but it can increase access, it can increase the ability to reach people, and it could be just as effective. But we also need the research.
Yes, we definitely do need research, and that's something that the field is eventually going to go into, right? I mean, telehealth is just coming along pretty well everywhere in the country. Obesity medicine definitely, is a field that the telehealth is going to flourish in, and we're already taking it into other specialties as well.
Yeah, and good news for those of you who may be local, we hope to be providing telehealth services on obesity treatment at the University of North Carolina within a couple months. So stay tuned and stay tuned around the country. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I went to my pharmacist to get a refill on my Ativan, but they said I couldn't get a new prescription without seeing my doctor. My bottle says there are two refills on the prescription, though. Do I have to go see my doctor, or has someone made a mistake?
Well, yes, no. And yes.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the expiration was for your prescription. You may have two more refills, but if your prescription expired after a certain duration, maybe that's the reason the pharmacist refused.
Yeah, I think that is exactly right, Samir. I mean, we see on the bottle, it says I have a refill or two, but you know what? I didn't need it for the first 3 or 4 months, but I need it now. Well, the problem was it may have only been good for 3 months, and so you can't get the refill. Things on sleeping pills, things like these medicines for anxiety. So you, in that case, you won't be able to get it without actually speaking to your physician or their office. And this is a case where you may actually be able to call your office and say, I wonder, you know, I was seen maybe less than 6 months ago. I'd like to get a refill. Can you call it in? Or the physician may have said, no, I really think you need to come in because it's been more than 6 months and I'd like to see you before we give a refill. In which case, you're really going to have to do that.
Yes. And as a patient, you just need to be a little more mindful of the fact that there might be some of these prescriptions, as you mentioned, like narcotics or like anxiety medications that you need to be a little bit more careful about and make sure you don't run away from the 6 month duration or 4 month duration that's on the prescription.
Even things like blood pressure or diabetes medicines will expire. You may have refills, but you won't be able to get them. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I have high blood pressure, and my doctor started me on a low dose of a medicine called Norvasc. Unfortunately, I've had problems with swelling in my legs. While my blood pressure is doing great, I'm wondering if I should switch to something different.
You've seen this before, haven't you?
Oh, I see it all the time.
Yeah, as do I. What's going on here, Samir?
This is the most common side effect of Norvasc or amlodipine. It's the class of drug we call as calcium channel blocker. We see lower extremity swelling very commonly. And as we have seen, we often end up switching the patients to an alternate blood pressure medicine.
And it really may not matter the dose. Even though you started with a low dose, if it's already happening a low dose, a higher dose is maybe worse. And it probably isn't going to help to switch to a different type of calcium channel blocker, a cousin of this one, if it's the same class. It's like, you know, if you're allergic to bee stings, you're probably allergic to bee stings of all sorts. And this particular one's a typical medicine. But there's lots of other good choices, right?
Oh, that's correct. We have lots of other blood pressure medicine choices. But the good thing is that you can be reassured that this lower extremity swelling that you had, it wasn't something that concerning. It usually goes away when you stop the drug.
Yeah, we don't want you to take another drug to treat the drug side effect. Let's get rid of the offending drug and get you on something that doesn't cause that. Well, that'll conclude our house calls. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us at online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Louise Metz, and our guest co-host, Dr. Samir Arora. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.